All right, gentlemen, this conference is being recorded. It's my honor to introduce Rabbi Twersky, Dr. Abraham Twersky, who's visited our call before, to help us understand and appreciate and take that enormously important step called the fourth step and the fifth step. So, Rabbi Twersky, welcome to the Guard Your Eyes conference call.
My pleasure. My initial contact with the 12-step program was 1961 when I attended my first meeting. I had inherited a detox unit as medical director of a psychiatric hospital, and I knew nothing about alcoholism, I knew nothing about addiction. And I went to my first AA meeting, and I realized that the 12-step program is not about alcohol, nor is it about drugs, nor about sex, nor about gambling, nor about food, nor about any other particular addiction. The 12-step program is about change of character, a character and personality overhaul. And that struck a note with me because the great Gaon of Vilna said that a person's obligation in the world is to transform himself from the animal in which he was created to becoming a spiritual being. We all come into the world as animals, and in fact, the book of Job describes it further. We come into the world as wild mules. And it's not enough to tame the wildness or to suppress it. It requires at least Yiddishkeit, Judaism, Torah requires a overhaul and changing many of the traits, giving them new direction. And I saw this very early in my involvement with the program. And although I never had a addiction, except being addicted to writing, I realized that I could use this program for myself, because although I had a fair amount of Torah study and a fair amount of study of Jewish ethics and Musar and Hasidus, I saw that there was an element in the program which gave everything a perspective. And that is that even though we have fine classes in Jewish ethics, when one leaves that class, it's very nice, and it's very good, et cetera, et cetera. But one does not leave the class with the feeling, if I deviate from this program, I die. And what happened when I became familiar with the 12-step program, especially in alcoholism, I realized that people who take the program sincerely and make a sincere recovery have the awareness, this is not just a nice thing to do, this is my oxygen. Right? If I deviate from this program, I will die, literally, not figuratively. And it gave me a new perspective on how I should look at the ethics of Torah, not as something nice, not as something convenient, not as something lofty, but as a matter of life and death. And so I took very seriously to the program. I had a difficult time finding a sponsor because nobody knew what to do with me because I didn't drink. But eventually I found somebody who understood what I wanted to do, and I began working the 12 steps. Now, at one meeting, the speaker began his talk saying that this was his 25th anniversary of sobriety. And he said, the man I once was drank, and the man I once was will drink again. And I think that says it all. What the program enabled him to do is to become another person. And we well know that if a person stops drinking or whatever his addiction is, for whatever reason, the doctor told him his liver is going to go if he continues to drink, and he does not do the program, and he does not do it for a transformation, he's a dry drunk. He may not be drinking anymore, but the personality is the same, and nothing has really changed except for the abstinence. So abstinence itself is not enough. And that's true whether it's food, gambling, alcohol, drugs, or sex. Abstinence is the first step because you can't do anything with with making a change while the person is involved in active addiction. That's like trying to find what's wrong with the automobile while you're putting gravel in the carburetor. Clean up the carburetor first, right? Get the brain clean from all toxic effects, and then we'll talk about what can be done to change the personality. So, having taken the first three steps, which were relatively easy for me, because they were basic Jewish principles, right? Recognizing a total dependence upon God, and accepting God's will rather than my own will, that was no problem. Then we came to something which is very emphasized very greatly in Torah, and that cheshbon hanefesh. Cheshbon hanefesh means a spiritual accounting. And all our ethic books said that we have to do regular cheshbon hanefesh, preferably every evening, to make an accounting of the day and what I did and how this affected me and what kind of changes do I have to make. And then the great Hasidic master, Rabbi Elimelech of Lizensk, in his instructions for proper Yiddishkeit, says, find yourself a person, a friend, or whatever, whom you can trust implicitly, and bear yourself before him every action, every thought that you have had. And the reason, he says, is because when you express these things, right, you're in a much better position to analyze them, to deal with them, and you don't have to repress them. Because things that we don't deal with often get repressed, and when they're repressed, they sit in the unconscious mind. And someone has said so truthfully that feelings that are buried alive do not die. So it is important to become aware of our issues, our character defects in the fourth step, and to verbalize them and be able to ventilate them and get some feedback on them. Now, this is something that is required by all the Musar works, by all the works on Jewish ethics. But it's something that people do not always do. In fact, I say perhaps a minority of people do, even though they may be Torah observant in every way. And it's unfortunate because they are missing a major part of the personality development that Torah requires. So, Cheshbon HaNefesh is, or fourth step, is very much a part of what Torah requires. And I found that when I became involved in the 12-step program, I found that I had not been doing it adequately. I thought I was an observant Jew, doing all the mitzvahs, right, davening every day and doing everything that I was supposed to do, but I was missing this important cheshbon hanefesh. Now, the Yiddishkeit has a term called Avodas Hashem, which we generally translate as being in the service of God. That's a little bit of an inaccurate translation, because avoda can also mean work. And Avodas Hashem means doing the work of being in the service of Hashem. There's a story about one of our great Hasidic masters who said that when he was a youngster, when he came home from shul after davening, his mother would feel his clothes, and if they were dry, she would say, you did not daven well enough. Because had you really davened very sincerely, right, you would have been sweating. Because work generates sweat. And, of course, I don't see people sweating in shul, which tells me that much of our prayers, much of our davening is lacks the intensity that it should. There was, as you know, if you've been at 12-step meetings, at the end of the meeting we'd hold hands and keep coming back. It works. Well, there was one gentleman who was a newcomer to the country, and his English was less than perfect. And when he closed the meeting, he said, "Keep coming back. It's work." Right? And we all had a good laugh of it, but then we realized what he said was true. Keep coming back. It's work. Recovery is not a simple, easy process. Now, we all like to find easy ways to do things, right? I mean, not only the addiction, but the people who are not addicts are always looking for the easy way to do things. And technology has given us many, many easy ways of doing things. But personality change cannot be an easy way. There is no quick fix. And it's work. Right? And you have to sweat. And it's not pleasant. And because it's work and because it requires effort, the natural tendency is let it go, procrastinate, or just forget about it at all altogether and give some lip service to it. Well, we have to realize that when we're dealing with addiction, we're not dealing with a simple condition that's an annoyance, such as perhaps hay fever, which is not pleasant, but you don't die from hay fever. We have to realize that addictions are lethal conditions. Untreated addictions invariably kill. They kill morally and they kill physically. They certainly kill the family. We're dealing with a condition which is a malignant condition, and if it's not treated aggressively, it's going to take the course of all malignancies. Now, for malignancies, a person may have to undergo surgery. That's no fun. May have to undergo radiation, and that's no fun. And may have to undergo chemotherapy, and that certainly is not a treat. And there are many unpleasant side effects to these, especially chemotherapy. Well, then why do people do it? Because they realize their life depends on it. And if their life depends on it, then they're going to do it, and they're going to take the side effects in order to live. And if we realize that addictions can take our lives from us, and there is no simple solution, then we will be willing to invest the work necessary and the sweat in order to get the transformation done. Transforming an animal into a spiritual being cannot come by easily. Right? And I might say this. I feel myself very privileged to have been part of the program, because I regularly see people who live very fine lives, superficially, but nothing has happened to them to make them take a very serious look at themselves. 99.9% of people who are not addicts never hit a bottom. So they work, they make a living, they have wife and children, husband, children, and everything goes on fine, and nobody rocks the boat, and then they live to be 100 years old and die without knowing who the hell they were in the first place, and never have made that personality transformation that the Gaon of Vilna said is the goal of our life, and is the mission that we are supposed to accomplish. And I think that it may sound strange. I think that addicts are to be envied because they have hit a rock bottom. They are in a position where they must do something about themselves. And I've often said in a lecture, do this simple experiment. Take a stenographer's pad and stand on a busy street corner, and as people walk by, stop them and say, "Pardon me, ma'am, or pardon me, sir, I'm doing a little survey. Would you mind answering a question or two?" Well, some people will stop and say, "Yes, what is it you want to know?" And you say, Have you ever made a fearless moral inventory?
Hmm.
And what's the reaction? What are you, a missionary? Right? And they'll walk away. Every once in a while, a person will say, oh, yes, I am involved in a program where it's required to do a fearless moral inventory. Meaning, except for people who are addicts in recovery, people do not do a fearless moral inventory. And if you don't do a fearless moral inventory, number one, you don't know anything about yourself. You don't have an accurate self-awareness. I can tell you that 99% of people who suffer from low self-esteem is because they don't have an accurate self-awareness. And low self-esteem is at the root of many personality and psychological, emotional problems. So I think that addicts are to be envied because something has happened to them that requires them to do a moral inventory, which enables them to make the transformation that everybody is supposed to make. But not everybody does. So it's so clear why the Talmud says that a Baal Teshuvah has a higher position, is superior to a person who was righteous from the day of his born and never did anything wrong. Because a Baal Teshuvah has had to make the transformation, whereas a person who was born from and never did anything clearly wrong, never had to make an accounting of oneself, never had a bottom, never had to make a transformation, and missed the whole purpose of his creation. So it's not only an issue in addiction. It's fearless moral inventory, and the fifth step of sharing it with someone like Rabbi Lezensk says is something that every person should be doing regularly. The only problem is that people do not want to take the time, do not want to make the effort. They don't see the need for it, and so they don't do it, and they're missing out on it. The addict has no choice. If she or he wants to recover, they're going to have to do the fourth or fifth step. Right. And as I said, it's not going to come easy. I also must point out, and I did this in a previous talk, that when I did my fourth step, I had to do it three times. And finally, after the third time, my sponsor said, now, I asked for a moral inventory, and what you've given me is a chimney sweep. I said, what do you mean? An inventory, you have to have the assets and the liabilities. All you've told me about is liabilities. All you've told me is that everything that you ever did wrong. I want you to go back now and do a true inventory and tell me your strengths. Tell me what's positive about yourself. That was harder to do than to find the defects. I'm not so sure why that is. Why some people are reluctant to discover their strengths. Perhaps it is because if they realize their abilities, then they feel the responsibility to act on them. You know, the worst thing you can tell a child is, oh, you've got such great potential. Kids hate to hear that. Because having great potential means I've got to do something to activate it. And that means effort, and that means work. I'd rather not know that. And I suspect that may be one of the reasons why people are oblivious to their personality strength. And I think that's part of the moral inventory. We are all born with gifts which we are unaware of. First of all, neuroanatomists, neurophysiologists tell us that we only use a small part of our brain. Probably the major part of our brain, maybe even as much as 80% of the brain, is never put to use. We have unbelievable abilities. You know, it's interesting. Grandma Moses' paintings sell for thousands of dollars. Grandma Moses never painted until she was over 70. And the reason she began to paint was because until that time she used to do needlework. And when her arthritis became so severe that she couldn't do needlework, she turned to painting. Where was all of that artistic ability for those 70 years? She never implemented it because she never had to. And then the arthritis took away her other distraction, and so she discovered her artistic abilities. I'm sure that we all have abilities. You know, the Torah tells us that when God created man, he breathed a breath of life into him. And our Zohar says, breathing a breath of life, when you exhale something from within yourself. And the expression that God breathed into it means that God instilled something of himself within every person. So there's something godly within me. Do I know what it is? Do I realize that God's abilities are infinite? And I may have enormous, enormous capabilities that I have not utilized. So it's important to realize both things. We have to realize where we have made mistakes, where we have deviated from what we should have done, where we have given in to some strong desires and some passions, whether it is for alcohol or drugs or gambling or sex, these kinds of self-destructive behaviors. And we have to know them, so we should recognize that and discontinue them and abstain from them and get the support from other people who've been there, who can help us with our in abstinence. And then to work on ourselves to transform what Job called the wild mule that we were born into becoming a quasi-angelic person. No, we are not supposed to be angels. Right? God had enough angels and had created man because he had enough angels and he wanted a different creature. Right? So we are, angels do not have to work on themselves to become better. They have no need for transformation. They are all spiritual. We are flesh and blood. We have many animalistic desires. And that's part of us, and I don't have to deny them. Right? I don't have to deny anything. That somebody said, anything human is not foreign to me. And I say, anything animal is not foreign to me. Right? I have every trait that an animal has. Right? Because I was born with an animal body. But whereas an animal is supposed to live as an animal, I am not supposed to live as an animal. My job is to transform. Right? And all of the 12 steps have to do with that transformation. Right. We were talking about the fourth and fifth steps, but all of them have to do with the transformation. Right? Asking God to relieve us of our character defects when we've done everything we can and we cannot do anything more, and then we have to ask God to help us do the rest of it. Right? Making amends, carrying the message, the whole nine yards. Right? And don't forget that step 10, I believe it is an ongoing inventory. A fourth step is not a single thing that happens once. Right? A moral inventory is something that the Torah writings say that we should do every day. And I know of people who every night before they went to sleep did a moral inventory. In fact, to reinforce that, wrote it down and reviewed it the next morning. Now, this isn't easy, and there's a lot of resistance to it. But there's also a lot of resistance to going to the oncologist for chemotherapy when you know it's going to cause all your hair to fall out, it's going to cause mouth sores and terrible nausea. Right? And yet you go. And you know why you go? Because you want to save your life. And this is where we are with addiction. In fact, this is where we are even with non-addiction, if we only realize how subject we are to our animalistic drives, and that we must overcome them and not suppress them. That's not enough, but we must convert them. Right? So that if we have passion, we have to turn the passion to passion for justice, to passion for good, to passion for kindness, to passion for to be closer to God. One of the things that the Torah says is that we are to emulate the divine attributes of truth. Truth. What's that got to do with addiction? Yeah, I think that is so important in recovery from addiction. One addict told me it was very difficult for me to give up the drugs, and it was a struggle, but I finally did it. But that doesn't compare to how the struggle is to stop lying. Because lying is part and parcel of addiction. Right? And we, inasmuch as God is absolute truth, in order to come close to God, we have to emulate his attributes, and we have to live with truth. That is not an easy thing to do. Let me just add something, which is a bit of something just came to my mind now, but let me pass it along because I think it's valuable. I had a patient many, many years ago, this goes back to 1962, who was a hypochondriac. And he was always complaining of one kind of pain after another, and it was clear that he was seeking medication. And so I said to the nurse, give him an injection of saline, you know, a cc of salt water, a placebo. And she said, we're not allowed to use placebos here. I said, what do you mean you're not allowed to use placebos? I always use placebos in medicine. She said, the director said we're not allowed to use placebos. So I went down to the director and I said, Dr. Winograd, what's wrong with using a placebo? And he said to me, Dr. Twersky, before our ancestors came out of the trees, they communicated, like all animals do, with odor, with sense, with body language. When we developed the cerebral cortex and we developed speech, that was superimposed on the more primitive methods of communication. But the more primitive methods of communication were not eliminated. Right? So we still communicate with body language. However, whereas we can control speech, right, we have very little control of our body language. Now, he said, if you're going to give your patient a placebo, your speech is going to say, I am giving you something. Your body language is going to say, I am giving you nothing. And you can't control that. Now, the greatest thing that you have going for you as a psychiatrist is your patient's trust in you. You can't afford to lose that. You can't afford to jeopardize your trust. Therefore, we don't allow placebos. That message came to me back in 1962. I might tell you, I stopped lying. I used to be able to justify lies like everybody else does, you know, white lies and whatever. But then I realized after that Dr. Winograd was right. And if I lie, I'm going to give people a double message because my body language is going to convey the truth. So I stopped lying. I don't think I've told a lie since in the last 50 years. Right? And I think that if we recognize the importance of truth, right, and make an absolute commitment to be truthful, we'll make a giant, giant step in recovery. Right? So we emulate God by being truthful. We emulate God by being patient, by being forgiving, right, by doing acts of kindness, right? All of these attributes are the kinds of things that animals do not have. These are human traits. And if we neglect them, then we're missing out on being the human beings that we were supposed to be. So this is why the 12-step program is so enormously important. And I wish there were 12-step programs for everyone. However, only people with addiction have 12-step programs. And it's a shame that other people cannot take advantage of it. So I think we have to feel privileged that we're addicts. And unless you have the good fortune to become involved in a 12-step program like I did, you're missing out on a very important method of successful personality transformation. So my friends, let me repeat. Addiction, untreated, unarrested addiction, is ultimately disastrous and maybe fatal. It certainly causes a great deal of destruction in our personal lives and in the lives of everybody around us. Right? And realizing the gravity of it, realizing that it's a progressive condition, if it's not arrested and not treated, then we realize the gravity of it, realize that it's like a malignancy, and we're going to have to take aggressive treatment. And does aggressive treatment have side effects? Yes. Yeah. Maybe not the mouth sores or the nausea or the loss of hair like chemotherapy does, but it has a side effect of all the unpleasantness and overcoming the resistances to be honest with ourselves and to be honest with another person. Right. But if we only recognize our lives as human beings depend on this, then we'll see the fourth step and fifth step for what they really are, and that is the way to redeem ourselves and convert ourselves from being the wild ass that Job says we were born, right? And to become the spiritual being that God intended us to be. So much for the sermon for today.
All right, Rabbi Twersky, thank you, so much for being able to share the insights and capture actually where we're at and what our issue is, and even more importantly, shedding light on what our opportunity is. There are a few questions that have been asked in advance. I'd like to give those over first. One of the participants says, firstly, you're Rabbi Twersky, firstly, thank you for giving of your time to help us who are drowning and begging for help. Although this forum is anonymous and might seem impersonal, it touches me to my very core, and I feel quite connected through this forum. You are not speaking to cyberspace, rather to real people with real problems who will absorb your comments in chizuk and will impact us for our entire lives. I have two questions that are really nagging at me now that I have the willingness to do whatever it takes to fix. I really want to do this right. Question number one, how can I confirm I am really an addict and that the 12-step program is for me, or if I'm just a Baal Taiva who needs to just work harder on my ruchnius by davening better, learning more, and especially having a Seder kavua in Musser? I know that my davening and learning can be improved upon, and that generally I'm a quote-unquote a good boy, but from time to time I get overwhelmed by the taiva trigger, by a random sight or thing, and I fall. And so on, rather, the taiva is not because it has been so long without it, I need it, rather it is completely random. So here's a man that wants to know, how can he really confirm he's an addict? So what would the rabbi have to say about that?
Yeah, well, first of all, the question of what's the definition of addiction, I don't think we have a good definition of an addict. I think if a person knows that what he's doing is wrong, harmful, destructive, whatever, right, and tries to stop doing it and makes a sincere effort to stop doing it and finds that he cannot do it, right, I think he can call himself an addict. I don't know what the importance is for giving it a name. I think that if a person comes to that realization, here is something that I know I shouldn't be doing. I know it's destructive. I'm trying to stop it. I've tried to stop 11 times or 100 times, but I haven't been able to. I need someone's help in being able to stop. Now, what about just increasing Torah learning and davening or whatever? I think that's a wonderful thing to do. But because of my identity as a Hasidic rabbi, I have had many people with various addictions, alcohol, drug, gambling, sex, come to me. And many of these people have been fully observant, Torah scholars, going to mikveh every day, doing everything that a person should do, and yet it has not worked for them. And the reason, perhaps, that it has not worked for them, I think, is because it was not done with the commitment and the conviction that we say in Tefillah, Ki Heim Chayenu, these are our lives. These are our lives. If we really felt these are our lives, then I think that the Musar would work. Let me give you a simple example, okay? I received an emergency call from the operator because my phone was unlisted, that a person is trying to desperately get in touch with me. I returned the call, and this was a guy who had gone through the rehab. He chance, one more drunk and you're out. And he was desperate not to lose his job. He did very well in recovery, did very well in AA for about 7 months. And then a friend invited him over to a party for his daughter's graduation and offered him a drink, and he said, I'm sorry, I don't drink. Oh, I understand. And then he gave him some punch. So he took a sip of the punch and he realized it was spiked. He ran to the phone and called me, and I could hear the panic in his voice. Doctor, what do I do? I swallowed some alcohol. Should I go to the hospital? I'm afraid I'm going to end up with a drunk. So I told them, look, my friend, call your sponsor, follow his instructions, make sure you get to a meeting. If you get into any more difficulty, give me a call again. That's what a person does who is recovered from addiction. Now let me give you another example. There's this guy who has a favorite candy bar, and the candy bar always had the kosher symbol on it, and he'd been eating it for years. And so he eats his candy bar, and then he's playing around with the wrapper. There's no kosher symbol on it. The kosher symbol was taken off. Well, the only reason the kosher symbol was taken off is because they probably added a non-kosher ingredient. I may have eaten something non-kosher. Now, what's he going to do? What he's going to do is he's probably going to say, from now on, I have to check things before I eat it, just not rely on past experience. Now, the Talmud says that sin begets sin. And even if a person had committed an unintentional sin, that still can gravitate and cause another sin. All right. Now, the alcoholic knows that a drink gravitates to more drink. Right. We say a sin gravitates to sin, but we don't believe it. Because if he believed it, he would have run to the rabbi and said, Rabbi, I ate a candy bar and I realized it may not have been kosher. What do I do? What can I do to prevent myself from eating chaser on Yom Kippur? So what happens is that the addict is in a much better position than the non-addict. And I can tell you that I've seen these people who are very fine people, very frum people, Torah scholars, etc. And yet, because they did not really believe Kehem Chayenu, that Torah is their life, and that any deviation from Torah is equivalent to death, right? That's why they became addicts. So I think increased davening and increased learning is good for everybody, non-addicts as well as addicts. But it's not going to take the place of the 12-step program.
Excellent. Okay, and another questioner asked as follows. There were actually a couple of them that had the same question. Said that I'm also OA. Overeaters Anonymous. Can the SA Fellowship help me?
Say, Bart?
The question revolves around, since the 12 steps are a generic program of self-analysis and improvement, is there a benefit in working the 12 steps to help with multiple addictions? Or must I join a 12-step program for each addiction?
Yes. I have a food processor. It does many things. If I wanted to slice, I put on the slicing attachment. If I wanted to grind, I put on the grinder attachment. If I wanted to beat a dough, I put in the whipper, right? The motor is the same, but in many different attachments for what I want to do. So I think it's possible for a person to be multiply addicted, and I think the 12-step program is good for everything. However, it's much more efficient if the person who has a sex problem goes to SA, and if he has a food addiction, to go to OA, and if he has a drug addiction, to go to NA. And if a gas becomes, I think a person may go to three or four different programs. Now, there's sometimes there are people who are unfortunate that they have an addiction that there's no program for. I've got one case of a young man now who's addicted to videos, and there is not yet a Video Anonymous that I know of, at least not in meetings. And he's at a terrible disadvantage. And what I told him to do is I want him to go to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. Whenever he hears the word alcohol, substitute video. But if a program exists dealing with a specific addiction, then I think a person should avail oneself of it. And if it means going to multiple meetings, we go to multiple meetings.
Okay. All right. Okay, Chevra, for the sake of time, I'd like to open up to questions. So if you want to unmute yourself and...
Hi, Velvel here. May I ask you a question?
Certainly, Velvel. Go ahead.
Yeah, first of all, Richard, I want to thank you. I met you a few months ago in your house. Your clarity and spirituality is very inspirational. You're like a wine. It gets better as ages. I want to ask a quick question. The focus of the fourth step, as we know, is resentment, fear, and harms done, including sexual harms. Is there a place in the fourth and fifth step to deal with, let's say, benodam la'atzmai, bad habits itself, whether it be problems with grooming, problems with other things, not necessarily addictions, but very bad habits, you know, to work on? Could that be incorporated into 4 and 5?
Quite clear. I think I got the question. If a person finds them health, instead of having some habits that are not addictive, can you use the 12-step program for them? Is that what the question was?
And also, if it could be in steps 4 and 5, or should it be elsewhere in the program? Yes.
Look, I think the 12-step program is God's gift to mankind. The people ask me the question, if this is so Jewish, how come it was devised by Christians? Well, this is a good time to be talking about it, because if you look in this week's portion of the Torah, Balak, right, there is the prophet Bilam, right? And Bilam was a degenerate, and yet he was given prophecy. So sometimes God chooses people to give prophecy to who are highly spiritual, and sometimes even to non-spiritual people. Now, I don't know the personal life of Bill Wilson, but I assume he was spiritual. However, whether it was him or the Oxford group, somehow or other they were inspired. Right. So I think that the 12-step program can be put to use for any habit, even if it is not a full addiction.
You know, in the 12th step, of course, it says all 12 steps end on about 8 words that says, and practice these principles in all our affairs. So, okay, good question, Velvel. Any other question, please?
Oh, this is Steve.
Okay, Steve, please.
Hi, Dr. Tversky, first of all, thank you very much. It's a joy to have you on the call and sharing your expertise with us. You mentioned something that your sponsor had said to you, that after doing the moral inventory of faults to find your strength to do the assets. I don't see anywhere in the literature from the Essay White Book itself or in the Big Book itself that discusses in the first 7 chapters about the process, especially under steps 4 and 5, any mention of making a moral inventory of your assets. I've heard it mentioned on the side in some tapes of someone who did a Back to Basics, but I was wondering if you could shed some light on that. It's not something that we've been doing in our group, and if you could shed some light onto its value again quickly, but how exactly to do it. Like what the column headers would be, for instance, compared with the column headers we currently have.
Exactly how they take logistics of it would work. It's interesting that one of the great Musar authorities said that a person who doesn't know his faults is at a disadvantage, but a person who doesn't know his strength is even at a greater disadvantage, because he doesn't realize that he has the ability to overcome these faults. Right. So, the person who was my sponsor, I was very fortunate. Even though it may not be actually in the literature, he was one of the early people. He died after 42 years of sobriety, and he was one of the only. They knew Bill Wilson. They knew the whole gang, and he was very basic recovery. The night before he died, he still wrote into his diary 17,000 whatever days, because he took one day at a time. So I go by his definition that he said that an inventory, if you were to take an inventory of a business, you wouldn't look at their accounts payable alone. You'd never buy the business. Right? You'd look at the accounts receivable. Right? You'd look at what they've got. So taking an inventory requires both looking at the good and the bad. Now, if it's not spelled out, I don't know why that is, but it's something that I think is very important.
Okay. All right.
All right, my friend, I'm going to have to leave the program now. So.
Well, Rabbi Twersky, on behalf of everybody who's been on this call, and I know we have a huge crowd, we really, really want to thank you. It's
wonderful.
It's
my pleasure.
Remarkable.
My
for
pleasure.
Your insight. And
good luck
to
everyone.
Thank you, Rabbi Twersky. Zag Zag.
Yeah, you have to get high.